From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. When you go to a medical appointment and finally get to sit down to talk with your personal physician, she may well be turned away from you, entering your symptoms into a computer database. Doctors now can consult with patients even more remotely over video chats. But what if an empathetic, face-to-face relationship with your doctor played a bigger role in medicine? My guest today is a physician. He says a compassionate caregiver can make all the difference. And he says that lending time, affection, and an open ear can do more than just the textbook doctor-patient relationship. This hour, On Point, how empathy may help healing. You can join us on air or online. Does your doctor go the extra mile to understand you? Or is your physician's bedside manner better suited to a bowling alley? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and the Facebooks at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Albuquerque, New Mexico, is Dr. David Raichel. His new book, right here beside me, is The Compassionate Connection, The Healing Power of Empathy and Mindful Listening. Dr. Raichel is the professor and chair of the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the University of New Mexico. He also founded the University of Wisconsin's Integrative Medicine Program. Dr. Raichel, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, David. Good to be with you.
First off, define briefly for us, what is integrative medicine? What does that mean?
Integrative medicine was born in the 90s, mainly from a public demand to have more options than just conventional medical care, and asked that we bring in science from complementary or alternative therapies that was known of at the time to use those to really influence health and healing within each individual based on their unique needs.
Okay, so empathy. I read this book, and it seems like it is not just a thread, but a river running through your text here. Tell me about the importance of empathy and how you came to be drawn toward thinking about it explicitly, rather than as a value that one might say, "Hey, that's a good thing."
Sure. Well, I first got interested in when I went into rural private practice in a 14-bed hospital in rural America, and when I was practicing, if I had to sit back and say what was the most valuable tool I had, I would have picked a medication like Prozac or Zoloft, because people would come in and see me and they'd be suffering, and I would listen to them, hopefully in an empathetic way, and they would tell me their story of suffering, and I would put that into a context that said, hey, you know, this is due to low serotonin levels, and I have a medication for that, and I would write Prozac 20 milligrams on my prescription pad, which we had back then, and I would rip it off, and then the angels would start to sing, and we both, the patient and I, both gave the power to the Prozac, and we thought, this is what's going to get you over your suffering. Jump ahead 10 years, and once I got into academic medicine and started looking at some of the data, the power of Prozac is just a slight bit more powerful than placebo. And what is placebo? It's the ritual. It's the process that happens between two people before that prescription is prescribed. So now we're realizing that's what a lot of this book, The River, as you say, is about, is how do we stack the deck in favor of the self-healing mechanisms within each human being, which is quite powerful. And most of the healing potential comes in that process of just listening, understanding the complexity of someone's life, and then putting that into a plan mutually where two people decide to go to a better place together. And that is completely undersold in our fast-paced pill for every ill medical society. And I would argue that this goes beyond medicine.
So let's take a moment. I mean, obviously, everybody feels as though they understand how doctors work because we all have them to one degree or another. And there have been a lot of representations in popular culture of how doctors work. One of the most famously uncompassionate would be Gregory House from the long-running Fox medical drama House MD. We have a clip here from the show. Here he's consulting a patient at his hospital's walk-in clinic.
The top of my head's killing me.
We spent a week doing top of head in anatomy. I know just where it is.
Ow! That is not the top of my head.
Yeah, close enough for clinic. Your sinuses are clogged. Judging by the scratches on your hands, I'm guessing a new cat.
Yeah, it was my mother's. She's dead.
You keep a dead cat?
No, my mother's dead.
Oh. Poor cat.
quartet indeed. So you've got Gregory House there sort of representing the dispassionate, if brilliant, clinician dispensing a relatively easy to fix or address symptoms there. You write a little bit about, in your book, about the traditions of dispassionate medical care, that is the idea of an emotional distance, stemming back, if I'm not mistaken, from one of the most famous doctors at one of the most famous medical centers at Johns Hopkins. What was the archetype doctor supposed to look like, at least as conceived at the beginning of the last century?
Well, I think your clip is an excellent example. House was a very smart, you know, portrayed physician. He was brilliant, but he had no rapport. And I think the House is analogy for computerized healthcare right now, that we have a brilliant computer, but it can't connect in a human-to-human way. And I think the archetype physician is the Marcus Welby that many of the listeners may not remember, but this was a very kind, compassionate family physician who looked at the whole biopsychosocial, spiritual aspect of each of his patients. And I think what we're going to see into the future is the need for a Marcus Welby with a smartphone. So we're going to have the intelligence of House, hopefully not his bedside manner, but we'll have that intelligence through artificial intelligence and computers. But we'll need more and more that compassionate connection, because humans do complexity much better than computers do. Computers will help us memorize things. You know, we used to admit medical students based on how much they could remember, you know, those people who are really smart. In the future, we're going to have to admit more people into medicine with more emotional intelligence, because that's what we're going to need more of, because humans can deal with complexity, whereas computers can deal with algorithms and images really well, much better than humans. But so we have to do what humans do best, and that's human-to-human listening, and it's human-to-human compassion.
Now, you write that this can even affect something frequent as the common cold. I'm, you know, remember some time ago Linus Pauling, you know, a great scientist, and nonetheless was a big advocate of the idea of vitamin C, that it was going to cure the common cold if you just nuked it with that. And the science didn't seem to pan out on that. You said there is research, however, that suggests that people whose symptoms in the common cold, who are received empathetically, who are heard out, who are acknowledged, progress more quickly and suffer more gently. How does that work?
Yeah, we did a study. Bruce Barrett was my colleague at the University of Wisconsin, and he was the PI, principal investigator, on a large grant that I took over the arm of that study that looked at human empathy, the perception of human empathy, and then the duration of the common cold. And we also did nasal washes to check for immune chemicals. One was called interleukin-8 and the other was nasal neutrophils, to see if the body was mounting a robust immune response to fight the cold. Before we went into that room, we pulled a card out of a sealed envelope that said either standard or enhanced. And if we were standard, we kind of gave the impression of bad cop, that, you know, you've got a cold, what are you doing wasting my time? That was the patient-physician interaction feel that we gave the patient. When we pulled the enhanced card, we stacked the deck in favor of all those the things in the literature that influence these healing mechanisms through this ceremony or ritual. And we call that the peace mnemonic. And it's all with ease, P-E-E-C-E. P was positive prognosis, that we would always encourage them that, you know, you eat your vegetables, you exercise. I bet you'll get better in 5 days instead of the average 8. The second E was for education. We would actually name it rhinovirus versus some viral infection. Whenever you give the person a sense of control, they often get better. E was empowerment. We would encourage them to go home and eat chicken noodle soup made by their grandmother. You know, what are the things that they could do to get better quickly? C was connection. And we actually had acting coaches who taught us before we went into that room, we either said to ourselves, connection, human connection, or disconnect. The standard visit was a disconnect. The enhanced visit was a human connection. And the last was empathy. And we practice empathy in that human interaction in people within 48 hours of the onset of cold symptoms. And then we asked the patients how they perceived our empathy. It didn't matter if we thought we were empathetic. They had to perceive us as really good in empathy. And those who perceived us as a high caregiver in empathy, their colds lasted 1.11 days shorter than those who did not perceive their clinician as empathetic, and the severity of the cold was much less.
David, I just wanted to bring in, to your point, a caller from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Scott, why don't you weigh in here?
Hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So I was a hospital corpsman, and I worked very closely in a kind of family care setting. I worked very closely with a number of doctors.
Mm-hmm.
What I found was that the patients were much more willing to go along with their care plan when the doctor was compassionate and took their issues seriously, even when, you know, behind closed doors, the doc would say, oh, this person's a train wreck. He would still go in there and, you know, and give them his full attention and compassion, and the doctor would go along with it. When they didn't, I found myself having to play kind of like a good cop, you know, while the doctor was playing bad cop, you know, to get the patient to, you know, because, I mean, being knowledgeable is not everything. You've got to be able to get to the patient.
Sure. Well, Scott, thank you so much for that call. David, briefly, in the next 20 seconds or so, how much does that comport with your experiences as a physician and as a practitioner?
Very much. And what Scott describes is something we talk about in the book, that trust. We need to develop that trust for anything that we prescribe to work. And trust equals competency times intimacy divided by degree of risk. So we need to go to school. We need to learn our stuff, but we need to provide it with intimacy. And that will make the science work better.
Dr. David Raichel, stay on the line with us. Stick around. Folks, we're discussing A Doctor's Guide to a Compassionate Bedside Manner. You can join our conversation. Has your relationship with your doctor helped you through tough times? I'd also like to hear from physicians and medical professionals. Do you find empathy aids your patients, or does it interfere with your ability to deliver more effective care? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of NPR's Embedded, and we've got a new episode all about how Scott Pruitt ended up running the EPA. It's a story about Pruitt's life in the Southern Baptist Church, how he handled a major pollution case, and why he sued the EPA 14 times. Just search for Embedded on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing A Doctor's Guide to Boosting Health by Practicing Empathy and Patience. You can join the conversation. At the urgent care center, do you get your doctor's full attention? Or does it feel as though they're shuttling in too many patients in a single day for you ever to be heard? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. David Raichel. He's author of the new book, The Compassionate Connection, The Healing Power of Empathy and Mindful Listening. He's a family doctor and professor at the University of New Mexico. David, thanks for sticking around. I'd also like to bring another guest into the conversation. Joining me now from Boston, Massachusetts, is Dr. Helen Reese. She's a psychiatrist and medical educator at Massachusetts General Hospital and the Harvard Medical School. She's also co-founder and chief scientist for Empathetics, a company that provides empathy and interpersonal skills training for medical professionals. Her forthcoming book is called The Empathy Effect: 7 Neuroscience-Based Keys for Transforming the Way We Live, Love, Work, and Connect Across Differences. Helen Reese, thank you so much for coming on Point with us.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
I want to read just a little passage from David's book. He's witness to a moment where a 31-year-old man who's been treated from cancer, married young man, is being told by his physician that he's going to die and that there's nothing. There's nothing he can do. She says, we've tried everything and that it's time for him to go home. And he turns to her and says, what happens when we die? And her response is the following. She says, I don't know what happens when we die. Some people believe there's a heaven. Some people believe we get to come back to life in a new way. I honestly don't know. But I do know this. Look around this room. You can feel the love that's here right now in this room. I believe you were conceived in love. You were raised in love. Love is here right now. And I believe with all my heart, when you pass from this life, you will be received by love. It is love. You know, there used to be a joke that saying, once you can fake sincerity, you've got it made. How do you teach empathy like that?
Well, that is a really fundamental question in healthcare and just about every other part of life. And I would say the key to teaching empathy is to put yourself in the place of the person you're speaking with and try to get that person's perspective of what would be the greatest emotional connection that would help them, and also what might your words convey that might address their greatest anxieties. So empathy is both having a shared affect or a shared emotion that helps us perceive what other people are feeling. And in this case, I think the question was coming from a place of anxiety. And also to take that other person's perspective. And so she was able to provide an answer that sort of spanned whatever his belief system might be and expanded to probably exactly what he needed to hear.
How reasonable is it for us to expect, Helen Reese, that doctors can take this on in addition to managing the demands of insurance companies and government regulations, in the addition to the needs of the advances of medicine itself? You know, it seems to me that we're asking doctors and medical professionals to take on, you know, a series of roles all at the same time that would require someone of extraordinary strength and presence to be able to pull off.
Well, David, you're really identifying one of the key challenges in healthcare today, which is that the amazing explosion of technologies that's helping us provide better treatments and diagnostic capabilities is also challenging the human connection that David spoke so eloquently about. So the ratings for empathy in healthcare have been declining for over a decade. And
despite the current movement you guys are part of and have described today.
We're part of trying to change that.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. Because you know, as a psychiatrist, I have a very privileged position to hear what people really think and say about their medical visits. You know, patients, when they're in need, are in a very vulnerable place, and they are usually very reluctant to confront a doctor or nurse about feeling that they aren't getting enough care or compassion. But I got to hear, you know, a repeated story over about a decade of patients saying that they feel doctors don't have enough time for them, they feel they're treated like a number, and that many times their emotional concerns are overlooked when other concerns are prioritized, like ordering tests or getting lab results. And that's why we really need to emphasize empathy training today, because it doesn't come naturally when people in the medical profession are so distracted with entering data in computers while sitting right next to a patient. And so we have one of the biggest challenges of our time, and the impact is not only whether patients are happy or satisfied with the visit, but as David's research and also a large study that my research group at Mass General did, we really showed that the patient-clinician relationship has significant impact on health outcomes.
I'd like to play a clip now. This is from back in 2012. The Buddhist monk and peace activist Thich Nhat Hanh spoke on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and doesn't so much of life come back to Oprah ultimately, but he spoke about the importance of what he called deep listening.
Even if he say things full of wrong perceptions, full of bitterness, you are still capable to continue to listen with compassion. Because you know that listening like that, with compassion, you give him or her a chance to suffer less.
That clip from back in 2010. Helen Reese, how do we make this tangible? I mean, that sounds lovely and aspirational, but how to convince people, perhaps even some of your peers, that this is something that has tangible benefits beyond making people perhaps feel better about themselves as practitioners or patients better about themselves as people?
So, first of all, I think most physicians go into medicine because they want to help people. They start with very high levels of empathy and altruism. And I would say that part of the epidemic of burnout right now has to do with a decrease in time and skills in connecting with people. So I reached into the neuroscience literature many years ago to really understand how it is that we have the capability to feel the feelings of other people and also take their perspectives, because our brain is actually hardwired for this. And empathy can either be downregulated when we're distracted or not feeling very good, or it can be upregulated when we practice exactly what your clip just demonstrated, which is being fully present. So one of the most basic ways that we teach people to connect is just to sit down. You know, instead of standing over a patient and looking down on them, to sit down. Form a connection, look a person in the eye, and show some interest in them as a whole person and not just an injured body part or a disease. And the reason that Empathetics was formed is that hospitals and clinics across the country really are looking for solutions. And when I developed the training, the empathy training at Mass General, and we tested it in a randomized controlled trial, we got significant improvement in patient satisfaction and also demonstrated improvement in the providers in feeling that they were able to recognize emotions in their patients and in themselves and to manage them better. And Empathetics got formed because the demand for the training far exceeded what I could do going around by myself. And so we have an online platform that teaches and provides this training to health organizations, for doctors, nurses, and frontline staff.
I'd like to take a call now from a listener in Ellsworth, Maine. Reva, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just want to say this is a conversation that is long, long overdue. And so often I have heard medical people talk about the placebo effect, but often it's just empathy. I mean, our family lost our wonderful nurse practitioner of many years, and it has very adversely affected our lives. And I'm having trouble finding anyone to replace her emotional intelligence.
Well, thank you for that, Reva. We'd like to take another call now from a listener in Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, go ahead.
Hi, David. I agree with what the doctors are saying, but I would argue that for a lot of doctors, you can't teach compassion or empathy. You know, either you've got it or you don't. Thank you.
Either you've got it or you don't. David Raichel, so let's pretend, heaven forbid, I'm in there. I'm a resident getting my medical training with you in New Mexico. What paces are you going to put me through? What unconventional or perhaps less frequently practiced regimes are you going to make me go through to, so that I can acquire empathy, so I can have a little bit more emotional intelligence when I walk into a room to examine a patient?
Yeah. Well, I think Jim has a good point. I like to be a little bit more optimistic that we can treat this. And our strategy for treating this is to have our medical students go through their own self-healing process, because it's really hard to sit with another suffering human being if we're burned out and we're suffering more than they are. So before we can do this.
What does the self-treatment process sound like or look like?
We have the three P's. So we first have our students pause and recognize how their mind has been conditioned. So we all have this unconscious or implicit bias. We all have beliefs. And the most important thing for us to do as human beings is recognize how we've been conditioned so we do not project those beliefs onto others inappropriately, which can often do harm. And we see a lot of that in politics today. Number two is we teach mindful presence, is how can that person be in the present moment on purpose without judgment with another human being? So we encourage them to recognize how their own mind has been conditioned so they can take off those lenses and sit with that other person with the beginner's mind or the child's eye, where they just are there soaking up that information that gives them insight into the third P, which is proceed towards health. Then they use that information that they sat and listened attentively, looking at all the biopsychosocial aspects and physical clues from that other human being. And then together, they work towards a plan, towards a better outcome. And that might mean a medication. It might mean forgiving someone who hurt them. It might mean getting up early and exercising. But it's a process that two people work on together. And and this feeds us. This is an antidote for burnout, because when you connect with another human being in this way, it's a two-way process. And we get out of that room, and I bet Helen has great stories about this as well. We leave that room energized. Whereas if I need to fix your fibromyalgia, I can't fix your fibromyalgia, but I can listen to your story and understand why your body has become sensitized to pain. And then hopefully we leave that room with a plan to help us relieve suffering together.
And in your approach, David, it's laid over the best practices in conventional medicine. That is, it's not that you're not trying to address the symptoms. It's that you're trying to additionally hear where the person's coming from and what they have to say. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, we've gotten really good at pathogenesis, pathos to suffer, genesis, the genesis of suffering or the disease. And we need to create a new complementary excellence in salutogenesis, salute health, genesis, the creation of health, which requires different expertise. And this is what we need to get our health system out of the most expensive and poorest outcome health system in the world. We need to add this value-based outcome, which is starting to happen.
Helen Reese, one listener commented online and said it feels to her that protocols have been set historically by male doctors, and that the ways in which people were guided as young physicians in interacting with patients for many years, many decades, have been set by sort of traditions handed on. I guess it's a little bit like what David was writing about from the days of old at Hopkins and other major medical centers. How much do you think that the dispassionate approach that had been taught in schools was in some ways centered around gender, or centered about the ideas of what a professional should look like?
David, there are definitely gender differences in how naturally empathy comes. In our study, where we trained resident physicians in a randomized control trial, we measured the level of empathy before the training, and women scored significantly higher than men. And I think that just comes from a very, very long tradition of being the caregivers at home, being attuned to the community, while men were more focused on, activities or hunting to keep the family alive. But I think that there truly was a belief that emotions got in the way, and that's why Sir William Osler, way back, recommended detached concern. Mm-hmm. And what we've really come to learn is that an emotional attunement is both enlivening and quickening in the relationship. There is a thought that too much emotion can derail the doctor-patient relationship, and we agree with that. We certainly don't want people dissolving in tears and losing their role. But a writer in the Journal of the American Medical Association talked about exquisite empathy, and that was the really enriching and energizing connection that happens between patients and their caregivers when they feel really understood, and the effect comes back to the caregiver. So as David just said, it's energizing. It actually is an anti-burnout effect, because you feel you're really doing what you're meant to do in your role as a physician.
And we'll talk a little bit more about burnout after the break coming up. But briefly, what response are you finding or measuring in terms of those people you train? What kind of satisfaction are they and their patients getting from that, and what kind of better results?
Well, we've been really thrilled to see that patients report feeling much more connected, that they are more likely to listen to their doctor, and really importantly, to share things that they normally would have kept concealed, such as, I'm not really taking those meds because they make me feel, sick to my stomach. So instead of pretending, there's a real exchange about what's working and what's not. And we also hear that, I've heard wonderful comments such as, I feel like I like my job again. We've worked with physicians who were ready to leave the profession because they feel so ground down.
Terrific.
And to engage is great.
Terrific. I'd ask you both to stick around with us. We're taking a look at how a compassionate bedside manner can promote health in yourself and others. We're asking you to stick around too. you can still join our conversation. Do you buy mindfulness and meditation as a key to healthy living? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the power of compassionate relationships in the medical field and beyond. You can join the conversation. Doctors, are you suffering from physician burnout? What helps you cope? Follow us on Twitter and on Facebook and everywhere else at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Dr. David Raichel. He's author of the new book, The Compassionate Connection, The Healing Power of Empathy and Mindful Listening. He's a family doctor and professor at the University of New Mexico. We also have with us here in Boston, Massachusetts, Dr. Helen Rees. She's co-founder and chief scientist for Empathetics, a company that provides empathy and interpersonal skills training for medical professionals. She's also a psychiatrist at Mass General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Helen, you know, we just had a caller from Nebraska who said, hey, empathy, you either have it or you don't. Can't be taught. You say, not so fast.
Exactly. So that notion that empathy is something you're born with or you're not is not accurate. And we set out to show that at MGH by developing empathy training and measuring it in physicians in training, and we found that through cultivating curiosity, by teaching emotion recognition and regulation, by teaching how to manage difficult interactions with patients, and how to learn how to deliver bad news compassionately, that the empathy scores on these physicians improved significantly. So I think it's very important to give hope to both health providers and patients that with a systematic training and good examples and role models, empathy can definitely be improved.
David Raichel, in your book, you talk not just about compassion, but about other kinds of treatments. And to be fair, integrative medicine itself is not without its critics or not without its controversies. You know, you mentioned acupuncture in there. I remember when it struck me, I must have been a teenager. My grandfather was a doctor and I thought an extremely humane family practitioner, cardiologist, and real lodestar in my life. But it astonished me when I realized that acupuncture coming from a completely different tradition could you could have gallbladder surgery without conventional Western anesthetic, right? And that these needles would take this incredible effect. That said, there are some things which are used, promoted as alternative medicines, incorporated in study or in practice by integrative medical programs that, you know, certain conventional medical practitioners say, you know, there isn't research to back this up. Let's just take 2-3 minutes and talk a little bit about the degree of scientific rigor that you bring to this approach to medicine, which, as you pointed out at the outset, is often in response to the demand from patients and consumers.
Sure. Yeah, I think, so many things come up. Let me talk first about acupuncture. Actually, at Helen's University at Harvard, there's a professor named Ted Kapchuk who did a study on irritable bowel syndrome and acupuncture, similar to our cold study, is actually funded by the SIM NIH grant. And he had acupuncturists come in and really connect with their patients with bloating and abdominal pain and told them how the acupuncture was going to help them feel better, it was going to get the energy moving through their bowels. And they really connected in one group, similar to our study. The other group, they just threw in the needles and left the room. And that group that they took time to connect and then explain their art and how it was going to work had much better outcomes than that group that just stuck in the needles and left the room.
Which is interesting. That's almost like a layered question, though, because you're talking both about the power of empathy and about what is to many Western physicians an alternative form of medicine. In some ways, I'm interested in just isolating for a moment some of these other therapies that you acknowledge or talk about in the book in some ways of provingly. I think in passing, you talk about Reiki, you know, which is basically, if I'm not mistaken, a practice of certain kinds of laying on of hands or magnets in a way that generates
a perceived warmth in the skin, yeah, and is supposed to have healing powers. A lot of doctors who I've in the incidental conversations I've had that talk over the years have said, you know, there's nothing to support that scientifically.
Yeah. I would re-ask that. I would ask the doctors,
how would you frame
feel it? Do you feel giving your patients a hug who you've known for 30 years after your visit helps them? That's more or less what Reiki is. It's intentional energy.
Do you charge them for the hug? You're certainly charging them for Reiki, right?
I would love to do a study where I have a depressed person come in who I know well and give them a hug versus a drug. And I bet the hug would work as well without as many side effects. And that's what we're seeing. When we study these things, there's an intrinsic value to every therapy. Mm-hmm. But then there's a ceremony or ritual around how that therapy is given. So if I can give something with less harm, less cost, but use the ritual and the empathy and the compassion in a way that helps that work better, then I have the most valuable, strongest intervention possible. And that's what we always want to do. We want to look at the evidence for the intrinsic value of any therapy. We want to look at the potential harm. We want to look at the cost. And part of the challenge is most of the things that get the best research have the most economic gain. Pharmaceuticals is a great example. Let's take forgiveness. One of the strongest things, therapeutic things we can do is forgive someone who's hurt us. There's no market for that. Uh-huh. So
when somebody says, "Hey, the NIH or that that these things have not been studied," well, that's because there's not money in the hugs or the forgiveness business.
Correct. And thank God for the NIH, because our government is funding some studies to help us explore some of these things that don't have a high market value.
Sure.
Without that, we would be very biased in our research.
I think prodded heavily by Tom Harkin of Iowa in the United States Senate for many years on kinds of alternative treatments. Helen Reese, one of the things I want to talk about was something David brought up in his book about the fact that this is not simply for medical practitioners, but that this is for caregivers in other elements of their lives. How's that played out from what you've seen?
I completely agree. We get calls every week from different sectors asking if we can provide empathy training in education, in parenting classes, in leadership courses, in politics. And when you really stop and think about it, any relationship where one person is interacting with another, especially when there's a power relationship as a teacher or professor to a student, empathy is so essential, because you want to connect with a person and find, you know, what is meaningful and important to them, and not just impose your beliefs and your values without understanding others. And that goes for attorney-client relationships. It goes for just any relationship where people need to understand each other.
We've got a pair of Seans on the line. First, I'd like to go to Sean from Philadelphia. Sean, you're on the air.
Hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I think this is essentially a mind over matter scenario. And the power of positive thinking really comes to mind here.
Norman Vincent Peale. Go ahead.
Yeah, the old book. The mind is more powerful than I think we can scientifically and objectively measure it at this point in time. And I was thinking about this larger topic just the other day. I think in the future we're going to have advanced technological systems that can do like a full body scan on someone. And just give them a checkup, as opposed to them having to go see a doctor and get a checkup. And it may eventually be mass-produced to where it's more affordable than having to go see a doctor. And at that point, I think, that might be a better option for a lot of people. And then if they want that empathy, they could just go see a psychologist or something. That's what I would recommend. But I think that's definitely
a differentiation of roles, it sounds like. Sean from Philadelphia, thank you so much. We're now going to dip into Boca Raton, Florida. Another Sean. Sean 2, go ahead.
Hello, David.
Hey, man.
I just wanted to note that not only is empathy an important construct here in the medical field, but it is of growing importance in the clinical field, specifically in the substance abuse population. Usually clients are coming into facilities and one after another they're being interviewed by interns and individuals who do not have the clinical background or formal education to operationalize empathy. And by the time they get to the clinician that is working with them, the opportunity for engagement has been removed. And now it's just attending to consumers' perspectives and the assessment and intervention occurs. So the opportunity to forge a very positive therapeutic alliance with the client has been removed. And, you know, here we are in a global epidemic of substance abuse.
You know, I want to turn now because that gets to a point that I'm hearing from a lot of folks, from our listeners online and in other ways. There's a listener on our website, a physical therapist, I believe, named James Lewandowski, who says that professionals often have to sacrifice patients' time for hands-on care to finish paperwork during treatment, that rehabilitation professionals have to really balance their work-life balance, but they also have to balance their time during the day, and it expands and expands. There's so much question about burnout. We have a clip from last year from CBS News. Dr. Amanda North at Montefiore Hospital in New York City, she was talking to Kenneth Craig of CBS, and she's talking about juggling family and medical duties and the way in which that left her drained.
I was stressed 100% of the time. And all I could think about was how much I wasn't getting done, all the things that I was failing to do, rather than focusing on the things that I was achieving.
Just a year into her practice, seeing as many as 50 patients a day, she was suffering from physician burnout.
Dr. Helen Reese, how do you deal with that, where you're asking people to take on, in some ways, more of an emotional load from patients and to take more time doing so, in addition to everything else? How do you deal with burnout?
Well, David, that's the probably the question of our time. The changes in healthcare have really led to an intolerable amount of work. And I can happily say that everyone in healthcare is paying attention to this now. And just the documentation requirements are being looked at with the advance of virtual scribes and real scribes, which means they're either real people or a virtual person writing down the things that need to go into the medical record to free up the physician to interact with the patient. So although it's reached almost a crisis proportion, these priorities are first and foremost. And it's very difficult to bring in empathy training when people don't even have the bandwidth to be looking at their patients. And so we are strongly advocating for relieving the documentation burden to enable a relationship to take place.
That is a recalibration of the balance. Maybe it's a little out of whack. We've been so interested in recording and itemizing everything that it's too onerous. David Rakel, tell me what you would advise caregivers, people tending to parents, to spouses, to children, people who are volunteering to help. What do you do when they get burned out?
Yeah, it's the same process. And, we see in healthcare that, as you mentioned earlier, that we spend twice as much time looking at computers than we do our patients, our human beings. And I think we're seeing that out in the general public as well. People are communicating via smartphones, and that's creating this loss of emotional intelligence that we're going to suffer as a society in the future if we don't do more of this face-to-face opportunities. But no matter what profession we're in, we can follow the same goals, is recognize what we believe, set that aside so we're careful not to just tell our child, you need to do this, but then just sit with them and truly listen with that eye contact, with that slightly forward set gaze, and show them that you care. And, Peabody said that the secret of caring for patients is caring for patients. and it really is that simple, that you take the time to give that other human being your full presence. And in that, you are a really good diagnostician because you connect with authenticity. You connect with what's really going on because you're recruiting those human abilities that are uniquely human, that is able to give us intuition, where we take a lot of various different bits of information and organize them into a logical conclusion. And then with your child, with your employee, with anybody you're trying to help, you then together open up a dialogue. A dialogue means meaning running through, where we find meaning in that interaction, and then we work towards achieving that together.
Briefly, I want to take a call from a former patient of Dr. David Rakel, Ben, calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Tell us what your experience was.
Hi, I just wanted to give an example of what you all have been talking about. I went to see Dr. Rakel with some health concerns. You know, it's been a while, and I can't remember exactly what they were.
It's okay.
But we kind of talked through what they could be. We talked through the possible tests for them. He, of course, listened very well. And he also pointed out the possible false positives and false negatives that the tests could yield. Also, we just kind of weighed all the risks and reward, cost and benefit, and so on. And after 5 or 6 minutes, 7 minutes, we decided to do nothing, to just kind of let it sit. And I left feeling very confident and satisfied that we'd kind of gone through the concerns, come to a reasonable conclusion, and that the conclusion was not just, oh, we better test you for everything just to be sure, especially given the potential for false positives and false negatives.
And
combining that listening skill with you know, the pragmatism of whether you ought to pursue testing was really helpful for me.
David Rakel, I'll give you the last word here on today's show. What is it you want us to come away from? What is it you want to hear us to hear from you as you talk about the importance of listening and empathy?
Yeah. Hello, Ben. Good to hear your voice. I think, you know, we need to invest in this human relationship. And this is why if you look at the best healthcare systems across the world, they invest in primary care, where a family doc or a general pediatrician or a general internal medicine doc take time to know their patients beyond their broken parts. And when we do that, we have a 13-fold return investment on our time. So every $1 spent in primary care, we get $13 in return, because that profession is focused on this deep listening.
Well, we are delighted that all of you joined us for this deep listen. You've been listening to Dr. David Rakel. He's author of the new book, The Compassionate Connection, The Healing Power of Empathy and Mindful Listening. David, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, David and Helen.
And also, you've been listening to Dr. Helen Reese, exactly. She's co-founder and chief scientist for Empathetics, a company that provides empathy and interpersonal skills training for medical professionals. She's also a psychiatrist and educator at Mass General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Thank you, Helen.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, get our On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.